This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. When husband and wife team Rindy Anderson and Casey Klofstad watched the news, they noticed a pattern. All the newscasters had relatively low-pitched voices, and not just the men, the women too. And they wondered what was going on, so they looked into it. Rindy is a research associate in the biology department at Duke University. Casey is an associate professor of political science at the University of Miami. And they thought about merging their two fields and try to get a unique perspective. So what they did was some research, and they found some surprising implications for all you voters out there. Rindy Anderson and Casey Klofstad join us now. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So tell us about this, how this whole thing got started. Rindy, maybe I'll ask you first. You were just watching the news and one of you noticed, hey, listen to those guys?
Yeah, absolutely. I study vocal communication in animals, and so I'm sort of tuned to paying attention to the sounds that animals make and why they might be making them the way they do. And so just from watching the news in the evenings, you know, we started to notice this pattern that newscasters speak with lower voices than at least it's our impression the average person does. So female newscasters on average speak with a lower pitched voice. And, you know, we just at one point turned to each other and said, well, why is that? Do we look to our leaders and people in positions of authority? Do we expect or want them to have a low pitched voice for some reason? And if so, why would that be? And so then in conversations, you know, Casey started saying, well, geez, you know, I wonder how this would apply to voting. And, you know, so we started paying attention to candidates giving speeches and ultimately led to the experiment that we did.
So tell us about the experiment, Casey.
Well, fortunately, you know, we're interested in voice pitch, and, you know, not surprisingly, other people have covered this ground, largely linguists and social psychologists. But fortunately for us, while we had a model to follow of how to research this, at least at the time, nobody had applied the idea of voice pitch mattering to political decision making. So just simply stated, what we did is we recorded a bunch of people saying, I urge you to vote for me this November, both men and women. And then using a computer program, we digitally manipulated those original voices to yield a pair for each original, one that was slightly higher, one that was slightly lower. And then we had men and women, both down here at Miami and then up at Duke, primarily college undergraduates, vote across each of these pairs, whether they preferred the higher pitched voice or the lower pitched voice. Now, we didn't tell them that one was high and one was low. We just let them naively decide.
Kind of, who are you going to? Which one would you prefer?
Exactly. Yeah. And our first bit of work that we did, the question that we posed to them was very general. It was just if they were running against each other in an election, who would you vote for?
And so you found out that not only does this apply to men, but also women, Rindy. Women generally with lower pitched voices are preferred when it comes to voting.
Right. And that was, at least to us, on the face of it, a little bit surprising, because our perceptions of sexual attractiveness are very, there's been quite a lot of work done on how we perceive the voice in relation to attractiveness. And for men, lower pitched voices are perceived as more sexually attractive. For women, higher pitched voices are more sexually attractive.
Now, let me get this straight. Are you talking about the pitch that I hear? So whether I'm a man or a woman, or I guess if I'm a man, I am more sexually attracted to a woman with a
higher pitched
with
voice.
With a higher pitched voice.
Correct.
If I'm a woman, I am more sexually attracted to a man with a
lower
pitched voice.
That's right.
That's interesting. And yet, when it comes to voting, we all generally tend to vote for the woman with the lower pitched voice. Less sexually attractive to men.
Right.
But somehow more commanding as a political figure.
Right. And so that's one of the reasons that we wanted to look at both men and women candidates in this context, because, you know, again, it's a bit of a conundrum. You know, we want our candidates and our people in authority to be pleasing. And there's quite a lot of research that shows that we vote on attractiveness when we're voting for leadership or when we're electing people for other positions. We want them to be attractive, too. And so while for men, low pitch goes in the right direction, right, for both electing and sexual attractiveness, it pulls in opposite directions for women. So we weren't really sure what we would find there. But then, you know, we find a resounding preference for lower pitch. pitched women candidates.
Now, Casey, my intuition would tell me, without doing any study at all, that there's something about a lower pitch that may suggest authority and leadership, and when I'm voting, that's what I'm looking for. Is there any research that would substantiate my intuition?
Yes, definitely. In the first study that we conducted on this, that was published, I believe, in March, we show that lower pitch voices are perceived to be stronger and more competent. So your intuition is correct that the low pitched voice not only is perceived to be electable, but perhaps the mechanism there is the perception of these quality leadership attributes.
What about in the natural world, Rindy? Your research is in biology. You study bird songs and calls. Is there any correlation there in terms of pitch and authority and how birds, what birds make of various pitches?
Sure, right. Well, it's actually a little bit clearer in other mammalian systems, right? So in the roars of red deer and elk and, you know, large hoofed mammals that use these long bellowing calls for mate attraction signals. And there's quite a lot of work that shows that the lower the pitch that a male can summon in his mating call, the much better he does attracting and mating with females. And that's because the lowest pitch, the fundamental frequency that's produced by the vocal tract, is tied in many mammals very closely to size. Right. And so the low frequency, the fundamental pitch of an elk's roar is a reliable, credible signal of his size. And females want large males because they want large sons and, you know, want males that
protection.
Will protect them.
Sure.
Right. So, you know, females are listening for that cue in order to choose the right male. In birds, it's a little bit different because the bird syrinx functions a little bit differently. And so there isn't a lot of work showing, at least in songbirds, that pitch in particular would be tied to sort of mate attraction or anything like that. But in some water birds and swans and these sorts of animals that, again, use these bellows, there's some evidence there.
So, Casey, this seems to further weaken our confidence in an electoral system that presumes and pretends to be based on reason.
Yeah. Well, on the face, yeah. In one of the difficulties, one of the ways that I like to think about this is that, you know, the selection of leaders is very critical to the function of a society. And ideally, you know, in a liberal democracy, we should all sit down, we should deliberate as to what our preferences are. We should then compare those preferences to the candidates that are available and make a reasoned choice. Unfortunately, most of us are not politically engaged enough to do that. So we rely on thin, impressionistic judgments, you know, lacking any sort of deeper understanding of politics. We rely on these thin cues. Now, some of them can be very reasoned, such as, you know, simply voting for the party that you identify with. But others of them are more subtle, and it's questionable whether they are actually correlated with leadership capacity. For example, things like attractiveness, or in a study we read, even the outcomes of local sporting events can influence voter decision-making. So what we're saying is that there are myriad examples of influence on vote choice, some which are reasons, others which are sort of more random. And what we're saying is that let's add voice pitch onto the pile. And sort of from a broader perspective, let's keep in mind that while we think our choices might be determined by our attitudes and perhaps our demographics, education and income, for example, we also need to consider our biology and that these decisions that we make are constrained or at least informed by our biological characteristics.
Right. And it's insidious, isn't it, Rindy? Because when we sit down to look at the platforms of the Republican and Democratic Party, we're engaging a part of the brain that is deliberative and we know what we're doing. But if we're affected by the pitch of a voice, that never comes to the consciousness and we don't know that we've been moved in one direction or another.
Right. Absolutely. And you certainly don't expect people to read our study or others like it and think, oh boy, you know, the next time I'm listening to the candidate speak, I'd better cue in to what that, you know, that pitch means. And you know, to the point, it's not even clear that voice pitch correlates with anything that should matter in the context of selecting our leaders. It may or it may not. You know, that's sort of the next big step.
Well, unless you need your leaders to headbutt a lion on the way to your calf, which is not what we want them to do. So perhaps it still does correlate to size in humans. I don't know. I doubt that it does. But Casey, it seems to me that this observation that you made should have come to the attention of political analysts and campaign managers a long time ago. Haven't they figured this out and done a little something with their candidate?
Oh, of course. I mean, what we are doing with this research in many ways is confirming with science what campaign managers already know, that you need to train and modulate your voice to, you know, to come off as having gravitas, having leadership, seeming quote-unquote presidential. An example that I like to bring to mind is the relatively recent movie The Iron Lady about Margaret Thatcher. A real big element of that movie is Margaret Thatcher receiving vocal training to sound less screechy in order to convey a stronger, to convey gravitas and leadership. And that was a key element in her rise to power in Britain. So, yes, this is something that campaigns know about, and we are confirming this with science.
You also have an article that's going to press now, Casey, called The Dating Preferences of Liberals and Conservatives?
Yes. So this is another sojourn into the biological world that I'm going on with some other colleagues.
Well, tell us about it. What are you finding?
Well, what we did is I created a data set based on dating profiles that we got online. So these are basically online questionnaires that we can then computerize and then do a variety of analyses on. And what we find is that, by and large, the preferences of liberals and conservatives are largely the same, which is interesting, right? We, in this highly polarized, hyperbolic world that we live in, with red states and blue states, with liberals and conservatives unable to even get in the same room to deal with, you know, pending problems like the fiscal cliff, right? We sort of think of America as a really divided country. But when it comes to our preferences for mates, the similarities are more frequent than the differences.
It's interesting. And, Rindy, you know, back to the research on the vocal trends and pitch in both newscasters and politicians, I want to get back to something that you found and what it means for women, because we may prefer women with lower pitch voices sort of in leadership positions. Mm-hmm. But it also means there is a difference in how we perceive them in terms of attractiveness and sexually and their leadership. And it's not true for men. So,
right.
So we're attracted to men and we think they're leaders if they have a low pitch. This puts women in a kind of a difficult position, right? You have a choice to make, I guess.
Right. Yeah. That, and it's interesting that, when I talk to people about this work, and particularly women, that's what they immediately say. They say, oh, so we're in a really tight spot here because we want to be sexually attractive, of course, but we also want to be taken seriously by our colleagues. And that gets a little bit to where we're hopefully going with this work in the future, which is the way that people can modulate the pitch of their voice based on the social context that they find themselves in. And it turns out that there's, there's been quite a bit of work done on this, but we can actually change the pitch of our voice within the constraints of our vocal folds and our larynx and how that's all structured. But, I can choose to talk way up here like a little girl, and I could do this all day. And I could choose to talk quite a bit lower and speak with gravitas. And, what I have found that I do is I change the pitch of my voice quite a bit depending on who I'm talking to and what the topic is. So when I'm at a scientific conference delivering a paper, you better believe that I'm speaking in a lower register than I might normally do. And when I'm speaking to my class of undergraduate women who are all 19 and 20 years old, I tend to speak a little bit more up here to match them. And so, what we're sort of looking at next is, well, if women within the constraints of their physiology have this conundrum, do they more than men modulate the pitch of their voice depending on context? Because that's sort of a way around it in a way.
Well, and it would be interesting to take that even one step further. So do they? And I'm guessing you're going to find out yes. I mean, it's fascinating to hear my children talk to my parents.
Right.
And hear them talk like they did when they were little grandchildren. So it's pretty clear that, I mean, it'll be interesting to find that. The next thing is, what does that do to you psychologically? What does that do to you in terms of who you your own identity when you have to be all these different people?
Right. Yeah. And I'll bet you that some psychologists have been tackling that question for a while, and linguists. And it will be very interesting for us as we sort of design these experiments to look at that literature and see, you know, see what the implications are for sort of social behavior.
And Casey, this, I think, speaks well of the cross-disciplinary approach that you've taken. And I think we're going to see more and more of that, not only biology and political science, but neurobiology, political science and sociology, all these disciplines now coming together more and yielding better research, would you say?
Yes, definitely. I mean, one of the blessings and curses of political science, depending on what side of the fence you're on, is that we like to appropriate the tools and theories of other sciences and apply them to political questions. And for me, it's been a really invigorating experience, you know, working with Rindy on vocal signaling and working with my other colleagues on mate choice. You know, I think of this as integrative research, and we have political questions that have always been there. But what we can do is we can apply new ways of thinking and new tools to those questions to really move the ball forward, to increase our understanding of these critical political decisions that we make in order to govern a society.
And in your case, you literally married the discipline. So
that's right.
That's pretty darn great. Well, look, thank you both for talking with us. Casey Klofstad is an associate professor of political science at the University of Miami. Rindy Anderson's a research associate in the biology department at Duke University. Thank you both for being
here.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to our program. This is The State of Things, which you find at stateofthings.org. It's a program produced by Alex Granados and produced by Sean Nguyen, Nicole Campbell, and Dave DeWitt. Christine Blythe is our intern, Robin Copley, the technical director, Brent Wolf, the news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.